What are you following into this new year? What is shaping your vision for this new decade? Now, I heard a comment this past week that the teens of the 21st century are really kind of a write-off. There was nothing that really defined them. When you think of the 20th century, well, you began with the Edwardian age. You had the 1910s. Victoria died in 1901, and Edward VII assumed the throne. And right until the beginning of the First World War, you have that period where you think of women in long dresses and those very picturesque hats and garden parties and perhaps Downton Abbey. It's also a time of great social tension when the poor began to realize that they should have a larger part of the pie in this world. And trade unions developed and women began to make noises about suffrage, and in Canada, the United Church began to take form as Methodists and Presbyterians and Congregationalists decided that they needed to approach this new century with a new church identity. And then the teens of that era were defined by the slaughter of the First World War. Some 20 million people died in that conflict. And it was followed in 1918 and 19 by the pandemic of the Spanish influenza, where estimates of 20 to 50 million people died. 500 million, fully a third of the world's population at that time, had that flu. And you think of that and you realize, you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing that our teens were rather nondescript and boring. Not always a pleasant thing to stand out and be remembered. But those teens and that violence gave way to the roaring 20s, and we move from the long dresses of the Edwardian era to the flappers with their short skirts. They were short for the time. And their hats and their, well, they smoked and they drank and they carried on in outrageous ways. Really not all the women of the 20s carried on in that way, but they kind of got that reputation. And it was the time of wild dances, the Charleston and the black hop, whatever that is. It was known as the time for letting loose, and why not? After the misery of the First World War, people began to feel a sense of life again. Yet it was life without so many young men. It's no wonder that women began to feel their power and their strength. In Canada, women were given the vote federally in 1918, and slowly through the provinces up until 1922, women were given the vote even in provinces, except for Quebec. They didn't get the vote there until 1940. In the United States, the 19th Amendment came into force and women were given the vote in 1920. Women went to work more often as well, partly because of the lack of young men, but partly because of the burgeoning economy and all these new office jobs which called them into white-collar work, and with income came power. And there was more that was happening. It was a time of great technological revolution. In 1920, the first public commercial radio station appeared. 3 years later, there were 500 radio stations. By the end of the 20s, 12 million people had a radio. And they were going to the movies every week. And they had refrigerators. And they had washing machines. And they had vacuum cleaners. And they had ready-to-wear clothes for the first time. And that freed women as well to go to the workplace and to simply take a larger part in society. And that created quite a revolution. One of the great technological revolutions was, of course, the automobile. It went from being a luxury to Ford's Model T in 1924. You could buy one for $264. They were an affordable luxury. By the end of the 20s, they were a necessity. And the birth of the car brought a birth of a whole new industry. Gas stations had to be built across the country, and also motels for people who started traveling around, and restaurants. There was a whole new economy. There was energy. There was fascination. There was a sense that anything was possible. And so it was. Except for prohibition. That was the 18th Amendment. It was ruled that liquor could not be produced and it could not be sold. It was okay to drink. There was a little legal loophole there. It's interesting, as the nation prepared for prohibition, they started putting away stockpiles of alcohol. It is said that the Yale Club in New York City put away 14 years reserves of alcohol in their basement, which lasted them through the whole of Prohibition. But with Prohibition came kind of a loosening of the hold of the law on people. They began to feel that they were immune to those kind of things. They went to the speakeasies. They bought from their corner alcohol salesperson. And of course, it was the time of the rising of Al Capone and the kind of glamorization of gangsters and thugs. People began to feel the loosening. After all, what had the teens with their ancient regimes and their monarchies and all those oppressive forms of government, when they threw those over, they also began to take the bit in their teeth and push the envelope of the law. And they did that in a lot of ways. This man's name is Charles Ponzi. He gave his name to a scheme, which he wasn't the only one who did it, but there were so many scams that went on in that time because people saw the rise of the oil barons and the rise of the gangsters. They all wanted to get rich, and they took every opportunity they could, and they got scammed. Charles Ponzi, well, he developed the formula that Bernie Madoff would follow not too many years ago. And people bought land in Florida, which didn't exist. They all wanted to get rich quickly, and the excesses led to many things. One of the things that it led to was it frightened a lot of people, and they retrenched. The 1920s was also a time when the Ku Klux Klan expanded because they saw it as the protector of the good old values. There was something going on in the 20s called the Great Migration, when the rural black population of the South began to migrate into the cities of the North. They brought with them a wonderful music called jazz. They also brought with them a wonderful literature. It was the time of what was known as the Harlem Renaissance, the flowering of Negro literature, not only in Harlem, but across the United States and in Europe. People who had no voice were getting a voice, but that threatened some people. And they cracked down, not only with the Ku Klux Klan, but they created new laws which cracked down on immigration. They wanted only their kind to come into the country. Does some of this sound familiar? Some of that technological revolution led to plowing land that should have never been plowed. And the environmental degradation led directly to the Dust Bowls of the 1930s. As well, the scams and the get-rich-quick schemes led to the collapse of the economy in 1929 and 1930. Sometimes to roar is not necessarily the most wise thing. Wise men and wise women can be deceived by the time, and we can find ourselves lost in a wilderness. When we look at the 20s we're facing, it's already kind of roaring back at us. The wildfires in Australia, which are only at the beginning of the season. And now the threat of a different kind of wildfire, as this is a scene from the funeral procession in Iraq for Qassem Soleimani. And it's only at the beginning. Sometimes one has to be careful about going forward. What are you following? What is shaping your vision for this new year and new decade? You know, the NRSV translates magi as wise men, but that's not wise, actually. The word in the Greek is magoi, and it's a borrowing directly from the Persian, and it's better that we keep it magi, because magi weren't known for their wisdom. In fact, at the time, the readers of this story, the Jews of Galilee and Judea, would have thought of the Magi as fools and pagans who didn't know what they were thinking or doing. They were people who followed the stars rather than the living God. The most famous Magi at the time was a fellow named Balaam. You may remember the story from Numbers 22 to 31. Balaam was a prophet, a magus. He was asked by one of the kings of Moab to pronounce a curse on the Jews because they were coming and moving through Moab to the promised land, and they were threatening his kingdom, and he wanted them stopped. So he paid Balaam to pronounce a curse on him, and Balaam couldn't do it. He says, I can only say what the Lord has me say. And even so, he tried, and the famous story is of Balaam and his ass. There was an angel blocking Balaam's path as he tried to go to pronounce this curse. Balaam, the great magi, could not see the angel, but the donkey could. And the donkey finally turned around and spoke to Balaam and said, stop beating me. Can't you see the angel? And finally he could. When it came time to pronounce his curse, it came out as a blessing. And he blessed Israel, and he said of them, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will rise out of Jacob. A scepter comes from from Israel. Now, his prophecy was of a king who would defeat Balak, that king of Moab. But Christians have come to read that as a different star rising. Not a star in the heavens, but a star in a manger. That scepter of Jacob. And so when the Magi come that are spoken of in Matthew, they also are not that wise, really. How wise are you if you go to the ruling king and ask, where is the newborn king? Especially when that king is Herod. I mean, Herod had a reputation at the time. Even Caesar Augustus knew Herod's reputation for killing his sons. Herod used to say that it would be better to be Herod's pig than his sons, because, of course, a Jew wouldn't eat a pig. The Magi seem to stumble around a little. They are, I think, well characterized by T.S. Eliot in his poem, The Journey of the Magi, and I have a little bit of it here. You may know it, a cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. Eliot never mentions a star in his poem, but you get the difficulty of the journey and these fellows kind of stumbling around, uncertain of their direction, wondering. In some ways, it's telling of T.S. Eliot's own journey. This poem comes from 1927, part of the Roaring Twenties. Eliot became a Christian in 1927. And for him, it was something of a difficult journey. He was ridiculed for his conversion, and it left him unsettled. His poem ends in this way. And this was all a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again. But set down this. Set down this. Were we led all that way for a birth or death? It was a birth, certainly. We had evidence, and no doubt I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our palaces, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. For Eliot, he had been plunged into a new life. His old life was gone, dead. And he struggled in this new era, this new year, this new horizon. It wasn't easy for him, as it wasn't easy for those Magi. They had to return home by another way. This birth of this new king didn't make it easy for anyone. Even this holy family then had to flee, and then there was the slaughter of the children of Bethlehem. We still go on, trying to find our way in this wilderness. A light has risen, the scepter has come out of Judah, and yet it is a strange kind of rain, one that lives by love. And all the vulnerability that love is heir to. So how do we go on? How do we roar into the 20s. Well, there is a beautiful story that comes from the Chicago Tribune. This woman, Betty Tucker, and that's how you spell her, Betty. She was, well, a cook in the Children's Hospital in Chicago, known as Miss Betty to everyone there. She was part of a migration in a way. She came from Alabama to Chicago, and she always loved to cook, and she got a job in the hospital, kind of edging her way into the cafeteria, and finally they let her be part of the dishwashing crew, and then they had her be a prep cook, and finally they let her cook. And one time, the director of the hospital decided that the evening staff should have more available to them than coffee and a sandwich out of a vending machine. So they decided to create a night shift in the cafeteria. And they asked Betty if she would do it on a temporary basis. And she leapt at the chance. The kitchen would open up just before midnight and go into the morning. And that temporary job lasted her about 35 years. Beautiful articles written about her in the Chicago Tribune by Barbara Mahaney. It talked about her. This article appeared in 2009. Betty was planning on her retirement. The hospital was moving from one location to another in 2012, and she had chosen that date. But the CEO of the hospital begged Betty to stay on, because, you see, Betty had become one of the greatest healers in that hospital. Everyone knew of her and went to her. You need someone to bring you life, and she brings it in the middle of the night, says Tasha Hargrove. You've got a lot of parents here who are sad, and you've got this woman. Not only her food, you see her face, and you know she's going to take care of you. Betty was a healer. Parents would leave their child in the room exhausted, needing food, and Betty would feed their souls. Doctors and nurses would be exhausted, and they would fall into Betty's arms and weep. And she would feed them. One little boy who spent most of his life in that hospital, he was born with spina bifida. He had so many surgeries, he was in and out. That hospital was his second home, and Betty was his second mother. Her French toast helped him live. Whenever he went into a surgery, he made sure that his mother knew he wanted French toast when he awoke from the anesthetic. And it would be prepared for him and on a plate, and when he awoke, it was stuck in the microwave. Betty was the one they turned to, their light in the darkness. But her light came from a source you might know well. She said, I say every night while I'm driving in on the expressway, oh Lord, I don't know what I'll face tonight, but I pray you'll guide me through. And this is what Mahaney wrote. It just might be that divine helping on the side is the most essential item of Miss Betty's menu. The one she stirs in every broth and every whisper, the ingredient that makes her the perpetual light shining in the all-night kitchen. If you want to know how to find your way through the wilderness of 2020 and on into this decade. Know the perpetual light that shines, the one that Betty followed, the one that is there for all of us. The way to the manger and the way to life. You don't have to be a magi. All you need to know is that you are not alone. Let us roar into the 20s. Amen.